Hi, thanks for checking out Press Play and our podcast. And when you're done with this one, I have another one that you're going to love. I just know it. It's a podcast about design and architecture, cars, gadgets, all sorts of things that make up our built and beautiful world. It's hosted by someone who is an insider who knows everything about design and architecture, Frances Anderton, and the podcast is called DNA. It's on KCRW's iTunes page, so check it out.
Deprived of sleep for days. In one case, up to 180 hours. That's 7.5 days over a week with no sleep, usually standing or in stress positions, at times with their hands tied together over their heads, chained to the ceiling. In the Cobalt facility I previously mentioned, interrogators and guards used what they called rough takedowns, in which a detainee was grabbed from his cell, clothes cut off, hooded, and dragged up and down a dirt hallway while being slapped and punched. The CIA led several detainees to believe they would never be allowed to leave CIA custody alive.
Dianne Feinstein, head of the Senate Intelligence Committee, describing the brutal interrogation methods the CIA used on terror suspects after 9/11. The committee released a scathing report today on the CIA's tactics in the wake of the World Trade Center attack. It found that the agency treated prisoners much more harshly than it led the Bush administration, Congress, and the public to believe, and that those methods didn't even produce useful intelligence. Josh Meyer joins me now to tell us more about the findings. He's a former terrorism correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, now a professor at the McGill School of Journalism. Welcome, Josh.
Thanks for having me.
Well, a lot of what's in the report, one example that we waterboarded people and also the existence of the CIA secret prison system, that has already been well publicized. What is new and surprising to you in the Intelligence Committee's findings?
Well, it's a long report, and we're just seeing the executive summary of it, so there's a lot to go through. You know, there's a couple things that really jumped out at me. Some of the techniques have gotten a lot of attention today. One of them is rectal feeding, in which they basically mashed up somebody's food and essentially inserted into him to get him to eat. So this is one of the new ones. There are some other techniques, too. To me, they made one guy stand on broken legs. They kept one essentially chained, I think, half upside down for about 20 hours. So there's a lot of detail that we haven't seen before. There's a lot of confirmation also of things that we had suspected but that they hadn't confirmed and in some cases denied. But to me, what's most newsworthy about this report is just how many people, even within the CIA, knew that these techniques were not effective and that they weren't working and that they were, in some cases, backfiring very early in the process, and then they, but that didn't stop the CIA from continuing them. So
right.
That's my big takeaway.
Yeah, here is Senator Feinstein on that very point.
At no time did the CIA's coercive interrogation techniques lead to the collection of intelligence on an imminent threat that many believe was the justification for the use of these techniques.
So, not one piece of actionable intelligence?
You know, that I noticed that, and, you know, we've written that in the past. I co-wrote a book called The Hunt for KSM, in which it goes into a lot of detail about, you know, the CIA interrogation techniques against KSM. I'm sure there were some things here and there, but the overall premise is that it doesn't work, that these techniques often backfire. KSM, for instance, was purposely redirecting the people that were interrogating him to search all over the world for other plots, and he was keeping to himself the details of ongoing plots that did end up going forward and killing people. He also kept from his interrogators all of the information about the courier that could have led to bin Laden, even though KSM was the one who trained him. So I think that the general belief is that it didn't work at all.
And the report also says that the CIA, in fact, misled members of Congress and the White House about the effectiveness of these techniques.
Well, not just about the effectiveness of it, but also just the existence of the program, how extensive it was, how many people were involved. But yes, I mean, President Bush apparently wasn't given the details until about 2006. But yeah, and, you know, one of my, you know, favorite lines in this was one of the guys who was the chief of interrogation for the CIA, emailed his colleagues to notify them that he had informed the front office of CTC, which is their counterterrorism center, that he would, quote, no longer be associated in any way with the interrogation program due to serious reservations he had about the current state of affairs. And here's the takeaway. He says he's going to retire, that this is a train wreck waiting to happen, and I intend to get the hell off the train, before it happens. So this is the head of interrogation for the CIA saying this.
What's been the response today by the CIA?
They issued a long statement, and the CIA director, also spoke about it. You know, they're saying the same things that they've said in the past about it, which is that they've learned from their mistakes, that they don't do it anymore, and that we should just move on. And essentially that's what President Obama said as well. I mean, he said that, mistakes were made, we should be looking forward. In fact, Obama's actual quote was, no nation is perfect, but the strength that makes America exceptional is our willingness to openly confront our past, face our imperfections, and make changes. I think that John Brennan said the same thing, the director of the CIA.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Let's hear now from John McCain. He also spoke today at the report's release. Here he is.
I know from personal experience that the abuse of prisoners will produce more bad than good intelligence. I know that victims of torture will offer intentionally misleading information if they think their captors will believe it.
Okay, so that confirms what you just said about Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. There was a Republican minority response to this report, and do you know what was in that?
Yeah, I mean, they've been coming out for days with some statements about this, warning that if this report's released, that it's going to endanger Americans overseas, it's going to endanger American interests, it's going to open us up to criticism from our allies. The House Intel Committee Chairman Mike Rogers was one of the people who has been most vocal about saying that it will endanger lives. So I think that, the Republicans are very upset that this report has been released. But mind you, this is just the executive summary. The real report and the redacted parts of it will probably never see the light of day. And perhaps the biggest takeaway from all of this is that that one of the top CIA officials years ago openly defied Congress and destroyed all of the tapes, the interrogation tapes. So we're really never going to know what happened.
What's going to happen to a CIA officer? His name is John Kiriakou, and he was actually prosecuted for being a whistleblower about these techniques.
Yeah, that's a complicated case. Without going into too much detail, he was prosecuted for disclosing classified information to a reporter. So there are some people that say that he wasn't a whistleblower, that he was just disclosing mm-hmm. classified information. But the basic fact is that he is the only person connected to this program at all who's faced any kind of prosecution. And I think that critics of this, and there's a lot of them, including people in the government, who say that some of these people, especially leadership of the CIA, should be prosecuted, if not for the tactics themselves, then for basically covering them up and continuing to do them without the authorization that they were supposed to have.
Okay, we're going to talk a lot more about that coming up in the program. Josh Meyer, former terrorism correspondent for the LA Times, co-author of the book The Hunt for KSM and a professor at the Medill School of Journalism. Thanks for joining us.
Sure.
And we want to know what you think about the Senate's torture report. Give us a call at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can join the conversation on Facebook, KCRW Press Play. And as I said, we'll have more on the Senate report reaction from a former CIA officer and a constitutional rights lawyer who wants prosecutions of the people involved. That's coming up next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. We've been talking about the release today of the Senate Intelligence Committee's report on CIA interrogation techniques during the early days of the so-called War on Terror. Joining me now is Reuel Marc Gerecht. He's a senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, also a former CIA officer from 1985 to 1994. Welcome.
Well, my pleasure.
And Wells Dixon is here, too. He's a senior attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights. Welcome to you.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Now, Ruel, let me start with you. Some of the tactics listed in the report that's raised some eyebrows today, rectally feeding and rectal hydration, near-death drowning, keeping someone awake for 180 straight hours, prisoners being forced to stand on broken legs. What is your reaction to what's detailed in this report?
Well, I haven't worked my way through it all, and so it's difficult to give a context to a 528 executive page summary without seeing more of it. I'm not sure there's really that much new here. I mean, there may be individual cases of abuse that we were not aware of. You know, the rectal feeding, I assume that's in reference to someone who wasn't eating. But, you know, that will have to be adjudicated. I mean, I think there are, you know, at least three salient issues here. One is, do you think that the aggressive interrogation techniques, primarily, I think the most controversial ones are probably sleep deprivation and waterboarding, are they, do you consider them immoral when used against members of Al-Qaeda? Do you think that the enhanced interrogation was a complete failure as a tool of interrogation and intelligence collection? And three, do you think the CIA lied to the White House, which would bring on also the question, I suppose, four, is Dianne Feinstein lying when she said she was unaware of enhanced techniques being used by the CIA?
And what do you think?
Well, on one, I would say that, you know, I have to say I don't find sleep deprivation or waterboarding to constitute torture as practiced by the agency. These techniques are used against have been used against thousands of U.S. soldiers. They're used against case officers in the training. And by the way, they're used to actually inform and illuminate officers, so they know that in any type of interrogation where physical pain is used, they will break, and they're not to be ashamed about that. And I have to say, historically, the rule has always been that if an agent were captured, the same is true of a soldier in wartime, that the other side, if they get a hold of you, they will break you and they will learn the truth.
Right. So these are the SEER techniques that were being used to train people in the military. They were not specifically used for interrogation until 2009.
No, they reversed them. They just the idea was is that these were the techniques that you could expect if you were captured. In fact, they were just supposed to be a small taste of what, and it's a small taste, which was, I can certainly say in my own case, which was illuminating.
Okay. Let me get to Wells Dixon now and bring him in, because I think the report details sleep deprivation for practically a week at a time. That's just one of the instances. And waterboarding used far more extensively than had previously been admitted to. Do you think that these instances and the other instances detailed in the report constitute torture?
I think there's no question that these acts constitute torture. I mean, with respect to the waterboarding, I you know, there's a fundamental difference between what has been done in SEER training and what was done to these men. Give you one example. There's a reference in this report to the waterboarding of Abu Zubaydah, who the report says became completely unresponsive with bubbles rising through his mouth. I mean, that doesn't happen in SEER training. I think, you know, with respect to some of the other techniques that were referenced, you know, according to this report, one of my clients, Majid Khan, was subject to rectal feeding. There's no clinical use for rectal feeding. You know, one cannot absorb food and nutrients through the rectum. This is rape. I mean, it's forcible rape, and that is torture. It's a war crime. And, you know, good people don't do these things. They don't do these things to other human beings. They don't do these things to animals. You know, these were not simply mistakes, but grave crimes. And there needs to be greater accountability for what's happened. There need to be criminal prosecutions. And
well, given the fact that it seems that the president has closed the door on that in criminal prosecutions, what can be done in your mind?
Well, I do think it is unfortunately unlikely that we'll see criminal prosecutions here in the United States, at least in the near future. That may change in later years. But I do think there is an increased likelihood of prosecutions in foreign jurisdictions under a principle known as universal jurisdiction. That is, the idea that if a state is unwilling or unable to prosecute torturers, that another jurisdiction will assume that responsibility as a matter of international law, and specifically as an obligation under the Convention Against Torture. I think that there is a very good likelihood that the individuals, that the interrogators who committed these acts of torture or the more senior officials who authorized them will be in great jeopardy in the sense that they will be subject to arrest and prosecution if they set foot outside the United States. And I think that's a good thing.
Ruel Marc Gerecht, what do you think? I mean, what should be done when the agency itself has admitted that things were out of control at the beginning, that they didn't have a good handle on what they were doing and mistakes were made, that the agency says that those mistakes have now been corrected? But should there be any accountability for those mistakes that were made?
Well, one, I'm not sure if out of control would probably be the right way to describe that. I think that has to be and has been politically determined, and it's also been legally determined. I mean, the Justice Department, at the president's encouragement, reviewed agency practices, and they determined, decided not to prosecute, that they determined no crime, prosecutable crime had been committed. I don't think there's anything further than that. Politically, obviously, this is going nowhere. Though I do suspect there's going to be a long and ugly debate about this, which is fine. I mean, I think it is certainly in the interests of the Congressional Intelligence Committees to rigorously review the American intelligence community. It would be better if that rigorous review were bipartisan as opposed to just being driven by Senate Democrats. But be that as it may, I think the whole idea of a rigorous review and debate is a good one. And I think it is fair to say that any practice that the intelligence community does, in this case authorized by the executive branch and probably, in all probability, also approved by the leadership of the House and the Senate, these things, I think, should have been better known and debated publicly, that if you're going to ask agency officers to engage in enhanced interrogation techniques, they should have full knowledge that they are being covered legally and politically. This now appears not to have been the case, and that's a serious mistake. So I think the Bush administration can be seriously faulted for not actually encouraging a much louder and public discussion about the practices they were using and allow democracy actually to solve that issue for you.
And Wells Dixon, I want to hear from you on that particular issue, because the Senate report finds that the CIA kept members of the Bush administration in the dark about most of what they were doing. And yet Dick Cheney has said he told the New York Times yesterday that that's not true, that the administration knew everything that was happening. So what is your determination in terms of how far up this went in terms of knowledge and perhaps culpability?
Well, I think that there is every indication that this went right to the top, to President Bush and to Vice President Cheney. And as you said, several senior government officials, former government officials, have said very openly and I think somewhat proudly that they authorized these torture techniques. The only way we're going to sort out a lot of these questions is to have prosecutions. The investigation that was done by the Department of Justice previously was very narrow and very limited. It focused on the destruction of videotapes and then focused on the question of whether CIA interrogators exceeded their authority, but it didn't look at what was actually happening, and whether those authorities were lawful or not. But look, I come back to the fundamental proposition that good people don't do this. You know, whether it's lawful, whether it's unlawful, someone says to you that you should go and put a prisoner in a coffin for 11 days, as this report says was done to a detainee, Abu Zubaydah, a good person is going to say, no, I don't do this. Whether it's lawful or not, I am not going to do this, right? When a CIA agent is told to rectally feed, i.e. rape, a detainee, you know, there is no excuse for that. Whether
it's lawful or not is
irrelevant. Good people don't do these things.
So now, is it going to be impossible to prosecute the prisoners being held at Guantanamo if they've undergone these so-called enhanced interrogation techniques?
I think there's no question that these prisoners, some of them, are being held in Guantanamo to prevent them from talking about what happened to them in CIA custody. There's no other rational reason why these individuals were brought and continue to be held in Guantanamo, as opposed to being prosecuted here in a real court or being released. But you know, whether a particular detainee is now not subject to prosecution because of what happened, I don't know the answer to that. I think it's quite possible that some of these prisoners will avoid the death penalty by virtue of mitigation. That is, the notion that they were tortured so badly that provides mitigating circumstances that would prevent their execution. I think that's very likely. But you know, whether or not they can be prosecuted is not up to me, and I think is to some extent beside the point. I think the people who need to be prosecuted are the torturers.
All right, we'll have to leave it there. Wells Dixon, senior attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights, thank you for joining me.
Thank you.
And Ruel Mark Gerecht, senior fellow with the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, thank you.
My pleasure.
Well, we want to hear what you think. Should the people who torture detainees be prosecuted? Why or why not? Give us a call at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can tweet us at @KCRW PressPlay. All right, coming up on the program, we'll take a break and go to something much more pleasant. Michael Silverblatt, our own bookworm, is here to share his top 5 books of the year. That's after a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Is one of your 2015 New Year's resolutions to read more books? Well, whether or not you figured out next year's promises, today we are here to help you catch up on the best fiction from this year, from 2014. KCRW's Michael Silverblatt is here now, host of our Bookworm show. He's here to round up his top 5 novels of 2014. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Madeline. I don't consider them the best. I consider them my favorites. The best, I would have to read everything to know the best, but these are my favorites.
Okay, so,
and I think they'll be your favorites. They're not just the best. I think you'll love them.
Okay.
I'm kidding.
Number one is Boyhood by Karl Ove Knausgård. And we talked about him on the show earlier, the Norwegian author who has basically written, what, 6 volumes of his life story, and yet he's got a lot more living to do?
Of which the first 3 have been translated.
Mm-hmm.
And the 3rd is the one that came out this year, Boyhood, and it's delectable.
How is this a novel, though?
It's a novel because he calls it a novel. We have to accept his designation. He's not telling absolutely the truth, and it's a novel because I'd say that the way it's written makes you think about life rather than autobiography.
Mm.
It's trying to answer the question, what is living? What does it feel like to be alive? An important question, often neglected by writers.
And he structures it A little bit like a novel. There's definite narrative tension.
There's characters, there's death, there's revelation, there's surprise. It's a novel. You enter the rhythm of this book, which is really the rhythm of breath, of waking and sleeping, of seeing and thinking and feeling. And when it's done, although you feel like some of it has bored you, you want more of it. Many writers, Zadie Smith, for instance, compared it to cocaine. As soon as she finishes one, she wants the next volume.
I know. I read the first volume over the summer, and I have to say, you read it almost in spite of yourself. You keep reading because there are large passages where nothing really happens in terms of a plot or action. But there's something about his writing that is so captivating. It's ensnared you in its web.
Yes. Yes.
Okay, so let's move on to number two of your faves of 2014, The Complete Cosmic Comics by Italo Calvino.
Well, someone had to do it, and finally it's done. This book is one of my favorites of all times, but finally The Complete Cosmic Comics. It's so exciting. Imagine this. There's a molecule who speaks in this book. He was there when the world began. He was there when the dinosaurs walked the earth. He was there for all of the major events of evolution. And these are little stories told by this molecule, Quiffwick, who's going to tell us what it was really like. It's so funny. It's so wild. Anyone who says they don't like science fiction will be able to like this because it's smart and it's scientific. It's drawn from actual science. Anyone who does love science fiction needs Italo Calvino because he brings it further than it's ever been. It's just beautiful. Now, Quiffwick was in a book called Cosmic Comics. Then came a book called T-Zero. Then came other stories, and they were never collected together. You could never gather them all. Some were just in magazines. Some were never translated into English. And now we have all of them. And I am so happy about this book. It can be given to anyone. Kids, grandparents. It's unbelievably entertaining.
So this is a great holiday present.
Oh, it's a great
present. For yourself or for someone else?
For everyone.
Okay, that's The Complete Cosmic Comics by Italo Calvino. Moving on, Lila by Marilyn Robinson. This is the third in her trilogy, I understand.
Yes, yes. But the first book is, Gilead?
Mm-hmm.
And then Home, now Lila. You can begin anywhere. This is the story of a woman who was a drifter during those Dust Bowl years when people formed bands and drifted from place to place asking for work. This is the age of Americans setting apple pies on the windowsill, knowing that hobos will steal them because they have to be fed. It is a world before the world turned indifferent, and it's magical to read how she comes to Gilead. She has worked as a prostitute. It's one of the things she has to do. And now she's living with a minister. They've fallen in love. And Lila is not used to being loved. She doesn't trust it. The minister is much older and thinks that she's just going to run away to drift. And it's a novel about how people come to trust one another and form a life. It's terrifically moving and beautifully done.
And it has received rave reviews. I read one description of her writing. Someone compared it to a Rembrandt painting, the way that she crafts these incredibly beautifully visual scenes.
And the shadows. the working with what is in the shadow. And she has always been a writer who works with light and shade. She captures, in one of the books, there's a baby blowing soap bubbles, and she captures the rainbow color on the bubble, or the green and the whir of a dragonfly. She's just a gifted, visionary, specific seer of what she's writing about. And you drift too.
The book is Lila by Marilyn Robinson. If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with KCRW's very own bookworm, Michael Silverblatt, about his top five favorite books of 2014. Next up, Hansel and Gretel by Neil Gaiman and illustrated by Lorenzo Mattotti. And this is a graphic novel that basically retells the Grimm Brothers fairy tale, Hansel and Gretel.
Oh, boy. Usually, when someone tells Hansel and Gretel, they get all colorful with the cartoon gingerbread house and the children and the candy and the this and that. This has been done first by Lorenzo Mattotti, an Italian artist, all in India ink. It's all black and white. You stare at this and suddenly you see, you focus, and suddenly you see what's in the picture. And suddenly you're reminded that this story is a source of terror. It's told about a time when famine was so great that parents had to give up or send away their children because they didn't have enough to eat themselves. And these children are in the forest and they meet a kindly old woman who offers them food, but she's fattening them up because she wants to eat them. Hansel and Gretel is really, at bottom, a story of hunger and ultimately of cannibalism.
And how does Gaiman handle that? Does he soft pedal that?
He says that children like to be scared. And when they are scared by a book and the presence of their parents, he just writes the story and leaves out the frills. So suddenly, you're shuddering again, and that's why this book is for different audiences. One, it's an art book. It's beautiful. All of the pictures are double-page spreads. There's no print on the pages with pictures. The print is on its own page. Gaiman has done a miraculous job of retelling the Grimm's fairy tale. It's beautifully done so that you care. I would say it should be with a child who is not going to become hysterically frightened, because it is a frightening story, but it's at the essence. At one time, this was what parents and children faced, and the story, the witch, the safety, ultimately, of the children. The children escape. Mm. The children triumph.
And don't they kill the witch?
They do kill the witch. And you have to. Sometimes you have to kill the witch.
I agree with you. Okay, let's end on Can't and Won't by Lydia Davis. This is another story collection from her. And just to give listeners a sense of it, I'm going to read the entirety of a story called Housekeeping Observation. Ready? Are you ready for it?
I'm ready.
Under all this dirt, the floor is really very clean. That's it.
That's the whole story.
Yeah.
I know.
They're not all that short.
Yes.
But she's known for that.
I wanted to include it because I wanted something that's nearly poetry, that's constantly surprising, that you can read the way you would eat candies very fast. And then for the first time, she explores longer forms in this book. She has been on Bookworm, well, since the beginning. I almost feel like I'm one of the people who discovered her. Now she wins every prize. Pulitzer Prize, an international Booker Prize, but she has done it just by being her ornery self, who asked for something else, says, can't and won't, the title of the book, can't and won't. She does what she does, and she's not going to do anything else. And yet over the years, I feel she's gotten so good at what she does that I don't want her to do anything else. I'm glad that she, you know, that's what a child says, right? Clean your room, can't and won't, you know? It's great.
And also, when someone reaches a certain age, the same thing.
Why
should I?
Why should I?
I don't have to. I can't and I won't. I love that. There's a certain freedom in that. Well, Michael Silverblatt, it has been such a pleasure. Thank you very much for
I can't explain being it, here. Madeline, but it's always so much fun to talk to you. You have such a gift at inspiring conversation.
Well, I just open the mic and let you go at it. So thank you, and thank you for your 5 recommendations. Those are really great recommendations.
It's a joy to be here.
Michael Silverblatt, he hosts KCRW's Bookworm, and it airs every Thursday at 2:30 p.m. Warren Olney is here in the studio to talk about what's coming up at 1 o'clock. Hello.
Indeed, and Michael Silverblatt is absolutely right. It is a joy to be here, but you only give me a couple of minutes.
He gets a whole segment. You're welcome to come longer. You're so busy.
Well, we had an interesting show today. We'll talk about, of course, the Senate committee report on the CIA, but we'll also have a fascinating conversation with Robin Wright, who is an amazing person, a journalist, who just got back from a city in Turkey, which she says has sort of become the capital of all of the Syrian war situation. I don't know how else to describe it. Mm. It's so complex that you can't quite call it a war. It's not a rebellion. It's just a very complicated situation, which she describes in wonderful detail. And she's right on the ground talking to the people who are experiencing the situation and sitting on a mountain watching Kobani with a guy who was a refugee from there, an 83-year-old man, while American planes are dropping million-dollar weapons on trucks and not making much of a difference. It's a very interesting conversation.
And what is going to happen to all those refugees?
Well, that's part of what she tells us.
Yeah. Okay, well, look forward to that at 1 o'clock, To the Point with Warren Olney. Thank you very much.
Indeed.
And coming
it's been
up...
a joy.
You will and you can. Coming up here, it's sports with the Sklar brothers, Randy and Jason Sklar. We'll talk about the end of Landon Donovan's career and how professional athletes are reacting to the news on the field and on the court. That's next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Santa Monica. KCRW is listener-supported. Help us continue to create and distribute our unique content. Go to kcrw.com/join to donate. And thanks.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Time to talk sports.
The sound of a cheering crowd.
Sklar brothers are here to talk college football, Los Angeles soccer, and why the Tampa Bay Buccaneers were using homeless people to sell beer at their games without paying them. Oh, my God, you guys.
It's so much to talk about.
So much to talk about. Okay, but first, we're going to talk about this.
Rip the three.
Okay, that was Blake Griffin's shot.
It was miraculous. It was an amazing shot. We were just at the Clippers game last week, and they blew out who they were playing. I mean, they beat them by so much that it just wasn't that exciting. It was so quiet in there. I mean, a librarian would be like, you guys can make more noise.
But no, this is a good Clippers team, and everybody's excited. They're getting the roles like this. Blake Griffin made a three-point shot.
Blake Griffin is a guy who usually, he's really worked on it. That, what I love about Blake Griffin, in addition to the fact that he's extraordinarily funny, he's a really funny guy, he consistently works on his game to get better. He's predominantly a low post guy who really does most of his work around the rim. He makes incredible dunks. He's this high flyer, but he doesn't shoot 3-point shots. I mean, that was I don't think he shot a lot of 3-point shots this year. That may be one of his only. So the fact that he made it at such a clutch time, you're like, oh, he's really worked on his outside shooting.
And it really looked like it wasn't going in.
No, it bounced straight up in the air off the front of the rim, and then it went in.
It's called a home court roll right there.
And normally, in any other circumstance, you would say, wow, the Clippers are really, this is their year. And then you look up and you see the Golden State Warriors. They're 18-2 right now. They are the class of the league. They have a new coach this year, Steve Kerr, who was part of the Bulls championship teams.
With Michael Jordan.
He was part of the San Antonio Spurs championship teams.
With Tim Duncan.
He was in the broadcast booth, and then he now... So he kind of is a student of the game. Everything he's doing is working because they're number one in offense and they're number five in defense, which is kind of a rarity in the NBA, to be at the top of the league, the class of the league in both offense and defense. And that's why they're dominating so many teams.
This has been a long time coming. They had a coach there, Mark Jackson, who was a longtime point guard for the New York Knicks, and he was... Mark Jackson got him to the playoffs a couple years. He really did a good job with that team, but the owner came out and said nobody in the organization liked Mark Jackson. Now, he didn't just say nobody liked him. He said, if one or two people don't like you,
that's one thing.
When 200 people don't like you, I mean, he was literally saying that everyone in the organization hated Mark Jackson, which is uncomfortable because Mark Jackson is now announcing for ESPN. So he's got to sometimes announce these games, and there's this feeling that, like, he really rubbed everyone the wrong way, which is why, after success with Golden State, he was booted out in favor of Kerr. But now the owner looks like he's a genius because they're doing great.
All right, let's move on to college football. And the big news this week is that the top four college football teams are now known, the ones heading to the championships. Mm-hmm. But this is a new system, right, that was implemented
this year? First year of a playoff, a four-team playoff. There'll be two rounds. Obviously, it's like a semifinal and then the finals. And this was supposed to fix college football the end of the year because there were disputes. This team was left out. They're not in the championship game. There used to be only one game to determine who was the national champion.
And there were always like three or four teams that felt like they laid a claim to, why aren't we in this championship game? And everyone could make a case for themselves. So finally, the NCAA said, all right, we'll do four teams. But still, this year, there are two teams that feel like they should have been in there.
TCU and Baylor. They feel like they were left out. And the Big 12 is a conference, one of the Power 5 conferences that's not represented. You got Alabama for the SEC. You've got Oregon from the Pac-12. You've got Florida State from the ACC. And you've got Ohio State from the Big 10. The Big 12 was left out. And TCU and Baylor are both in the Big 12. So now you've got a situation where those two teams are left out. And Randy and I were discussing it earlier. We were talking about the NCAA basketball tournament. There are now 68 teams in that tournament. And still teams feel like they belong, and they're not
in. So no matter how big you expand the tournament, there will always be bubble teams that think that they should be
in. That everyone should get a trophy.
Exactly. Well, on some level. But we'll see what happens. I actually think they actually got it right, and the four best teams are in there right now.
All right. Galaxy.
Amazing.
Amazing. Landon Donovan says goodbye.
Landy Cakes.
He's the most decorated professional athlete in this area.
He is. And you think about the year that he had, it was kind of a roller coaster because he was left off the World Cup team last summer.
Jurgen Klinsmann felt like he had taken a little bit of a hiatus, Landon Donovan, and he felt like he wasn't training hard, and he represented why U.S. soccer was soft. And so Jurgen Klinsmann...
Well, then it was soft at the World Cup.
It kind of was. I mean, the thing was, we could have used Landon Donovan in the World Cup, but Jurgen Klinsmann is trying to change the culture of soccer. And so it's an interesting thing. So he was left off and was really down the lowest of lows, and he doesn't want to leave soccer on that sour of a note.
So comes back to the MLS, wins the MLS, goes out on top. And it's so funny because we think about Landon Donovan. He's been around forever, right? He's only 32 years old.
16 years he's been
playing.
But
he is the star.
I think he is, you know, for American soccer over the past decade or so, he is really the face of American soccer. Obviously, new people have to emerge.
And definitely on the Galaxy, a new player, Robbie Keane, who was a big English Premier League player who's come over to America to play for
the league MVP.
He's the league MVP. He's the new star in the Galaxy.
But think about this. Landon Donovan has 6 titles. Kobe Bryant has 5. So Landon Donovan is now the most decorated you know, not to add more salt onto Kobe's wounds, they're having a terrible year. But Landon Donovan's the most decorated Los Angeles-based athlete right now.
And so where does he go from here?
You know, I think he'll go into the announcing booth.
He'll be an announcer, or he'll maybe go into coaching. But he's a guy who, you know, he's done enough that I feel like he should have a life in soccer.
And certainly with the U.S. men's soccer team, he should be involved on some.
Maybe. Well, we'll see. Again, he had that friction with Klinsmann, so we'll see what happens.
And you guys, sports and politics, they don't mix, but we've been seeing some political action both on the NBA courts and on the NFL playing fields.
Yeah.
And tell us about that.
It's pretty amazing. I mean, I'm pretty proud of the NBA players, especially players like LeBron James, who is literally the best player in the NBA, the face of the NBA.
Maybe the most recognizable athlete on the planet.
Really went out on somewhat of a limb wearing a shirt, the I Can't Breathe, you know, sort of as tribute to Eric Garner. I mean, taking a huge stand while in warmups. Basically, Derrick Rose did it, and in football, Reggie Bush for the Detroit Lions, a local guy, he did it. But, you know, they all just sort of put that on there to say, like, look, we're supporting this family. And I know the NBA is a business and we might get rub some people the wrong way with this, but this is the way I feel. And it harkens back to days when you had people like, you know, Lew Alcindor, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, or Muhammad Ali, when athletes were really outspoken about what they felt. And I feel like we've sort of come way, 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 you know, way
as,
back
as that. Sports have become more and more commodified, you see less players willing to go out on a limb.
But I
like
think
that.
This.
But didn't you see one player I recall getting criticized for putting his hands up?
Oh, the five the Rams players.
Michael Brown.
The hands up, don't shoot. The Rams receiving corps, St. Louis Rams. This is crazy. They put their hands up. They entered into the game, hands up, don't shoot. This
when
is
they
too
came
exciting.
Out of the tunnel.
Yeah.
And the St. Louis police department said,
was upset. They said, you need to discipline these guys. St. Louis Police Department.
And the Rams
said to the
were
Rams,
like, it's free speech. They can do
what they
want.
They can
do
whatever
do.
They want.
And then, the Rams said they had a very good discussion with the police department and positive, and they got out what they wanted.
So then the police tweeted that the Rams apologized. And the Rams said,
then
we didn't.
Tweeted,
we never
apologized.
Then the police department tweeted the definition of an apology. They got into a Twitter war. It's like, leave it alone.
Right.
I mean, it's an amazing thing that you're seeing these athletes stand up in a time where a lot of these guys came from neighborhoods where they felt this pressure and they felt that they can identify with these kids and these people. And they're saying to themselves,
look, we have a platform and we need to say something.
We can't take it anymore.
All right, let's get to this Tampa Bay homeless story. It appears that professional football and baseball teams were using homeless people to sell concessions and not paying them.
Yeah, and that's a little bit misleading because, I mean, I guess Tampa Bay should have, the teams, the Buccaneers and the Tampa Bay Rays, should have looked into it a little bit more. But
they hire a concessionaire, and the concessionaire then hires people. And they're using this this homeless shelter, New Beginnings is the name of the shelter. And New Beginnings was using homeless people and not paying them. So they would work the concession stand, not get paid, and that what they were saying is the hours they worked went towards paying down their rent at the homeless shelter.
Which is news to me because I had no idea that Tampa Bay was operating under the feudal system.
It's
why
so
are
odd.
There serfs? I don't understand. Like a homeless shelter should ostensibly be a place where you get back up on your feet. Like you shouldn't have to work somewhere to then.
You shouldn't be in debt to the homeless shelter for your rent and your food. And a lot of people are calling them out on this, and they're now under investigation. New Beginnings. It's like New Endings. That's what they should
so
call.
So were they getting paid by the sports teams, this
no.
homeless shelter?
The New Beginnings
well,
was being
yes,
paid.
Yes, yes.
The shelter itself.
The shelter itself was getting paid, but the people themselves who were working were not getting paid.
The shelter was saying, this goes towards your food and room and board that we offer you, the shelter we offer you here. And they're still asking for grants and still asking for money. They asked for a multi-million dollar grant this year that got denied. Apparently an auditor said that his signature was forged by New Beginnings
so that the audit was a fraud. This is not exactly
That's not good.
The most reputable place.
So were they at all trying to sugarcoat it with the homeless
doing
people
a nice
saying,
thing.
Like, look, here's some job training.
They
you get
weren't
to watch
even
the
saying
game.
That. They're right, exactly. They weren't
Free
even saying
food.
You don't get to even watch the game. You're working hard at a concession stand. I mean, I don't know if they're even allowed to eat the food there. It definitely isn't the right setup, and they got called on it. And Randy and I were saying, look, if Tampa Bay was at the top of the league, then maybe we wouldn't be looking into all their issues and their problems. But
they've won two games this year. It's
so
like
now
you kind of
look
suddenly
at all the
everybody
problems.
Looks at everything that's going on, and you look. I'm gonna say this. Maybe it's a good thing.
Randy and Jason Sklar, hosts of Sklarborough Country, the podcast, and you can watch them on Newsreaders on the Cartoon Network's Adult Swim Thursday night at midnight. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
Julie Myers, hello there.
The Sklars make me want to have a twin. So bad.
You have an evil twin.
Not the twin in my own head.
He's right behind you.
Okay, so this segment is the equivalent of the clutch three-pointer at the buzzer, right?
Yes.
Okay, so more seriously, we spent a good portion of the show talking about this new Senate report on U.S. use of torture. We wanted to give you all an opportunity to react as well. On Facebook, listener Lindsay Ross says that she loves America and the ideals that we hold as Americans, but she's not surprised about the findings in this report. How are we supposed to resolve those two things, our love of American ideals and our willingness to torture people? Todd Smith tweeted that he just can't understand how people wouldn't call simulated drowning torture. Brian Griffith also tweeted us. He says that if rectal feeding is technically legal, we need to seriously examine who we are as a country. This is wrong, no question. Virginia Rodas Terry on Facebook says that what's hardest to believe about this torture report is that the White House was unaware of the torture. Hard to believe. And Rachel Christian Burkhart says that this report is horrendous. The CIA officials should be prosecuted. These are humanitarian war crimes. We are better than this. So there's a lot of damning of the CIA on Facebook and Twitter right now. If you all want to weigh in, visit us on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play, Twitter at KCRW Press Play.
All right. Thank you very much, Julie Myers. Of course, we will have a lot more on the Senate report coming up on To the Point with Warren Olney at 1 o'clock. And that's it for me. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a great afternoon. I'll see you tomorrow.